This is the lecture for BioChem 421 for October 29, 2009.
All right, so we're talking now about, this is a chapter 13 lecture. Today is October 29. You know, I'm date challenged as it is, let alone having somebody shout out these apparently random numbers. No, 29. So, soon to be Halloween. No big deal. You know, oddly enough, when I was growing up, you know, and I was in the church and listened to all these different sermons and stuff, I thought, you know, the state of the dead, you know, how can you build a church, or how can you make that such a big hairy deal on the state of the dead? And I've come to realize that having a clear view of the state of the dead actually is both a very powerful tool. As it were, very powerful statement about our understanding of the Bible. And also has very practical effects, pardon me. I'll cut this out of the lecture. But anyway, I remember 9/11, and who can forget? And the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, and these heroes that were on that plane that tried to fight to get it back, and they died trying. And one of those heroes had a small family, two young girls and a wife, and the mother was trying to explain where the little girl's dad was, and so she said, you know, well, honey, daddy can't come home anymore. He's dead and he's in heaven. Oh, really? He's in heaven? Yeah. Well, why can't I talk to him? Well, he's there, and he can't talk to you. Well, can he call me? Can he use his cell phone? Well, how about, can he email me? I know I like to read emails from Daddy. Now, you know, when you think about the lunacy of a God that takes a father away from the child and has the father alive in heaven, looking down on his children, as it were. And the child wants to talk to the father, and the father wants, and it can't. I mean, that's absolutely insanity. I mean, how many people have lost their faith because how they think God is keeping them from their own family? Because their family is alive in heaven and walking around but can't talk to them. Can't be a part of their lives. They're looking down on them and in tragedy and stuff. And I just cringe when people say, you know, well, you hear this all the time on news reports. Well, I know George is looking down on us from heaven now, and he would be proud of this event. How much more comforting is it to know that no matter where that body is, God is watching over the soul. And that person is asleep. Is asleep. The sleep of death. It's a comfort to me to realize that when I die, I will be asleep. Just asleep. Ready for God to wake me up. And he said that. How many times did Jesus say to somebody in the New Testament, he's not dead. He's what? Asleep. Asleep, ladies and gentlemen. Asleep. And yet we go through some denominations go through these convoluted arguments to say that they're not asleep. At any rate, so I know it doesn't sound like a rational thing. I mean, at your age, death and dying and all that kind of thing. But in reality, one of the most comforting ideas that I, as a Seventh-day Adventist, have, besides what I believe in our name. I mean, we have a great name. As a church, Seventh-day Adventist Church. It tells people what we are. There are many churches. First Church of God. First Assemblies of God. I mean, those are great names. Don't let me go wrong. But Seventh-day Adventists tell people what we believe right off. The seventh day and Advent. God is coming again. I mean, what a powerful... Just saying the name is a testimony to what we believe. And yet, in addition, then we have the comfort of, I think, having the most accurate understanding of the state of the dead. And how that can, in fact, be a comfort to those who are in loss. Any rate, so I don't mean to go down that direction. It just struck me as something that needed to be said. All right, so we're going to start now. We're somewhere in this. I forgot to mention something about this particular diagram here. I'm not sure what page number, what chart number that is. That's... Oh, no. Do you see it? You have that. It's got to be in there. It's pretty early. It's a couple things before. Yeah, it's at the bottom. It's right up in the corner. It's like number 14 or 15 in, I think. And there's a chart that shows the time versus concentration of a variety of things. This is an experimentally determined, although idealized chart. And the time frame is not that long. It's only a few seconds, actually. But the concentration on the vertical axis, the concentration initially only has the enzyme total and the total amount of substrate, or the reactant, as it were, in this enzyme reaction. They then allow the reaction to begin, and immediately the concentration of ET drops. The concentration of ET drops, because the ET, the enzyme total, once it's exposed to the substrate, then comes into two forms. The free enzyme and the enzyme substrate. When you look at this diagram, you realize immediately that the free enzyme is only a relatively small proportion of the total enzyme. That most, but not all, but most of the enzyme is bound up in this enzyme substrate complex. You see, as that enzyme substrate exists, it continually is acting on the substrate and continually increasing the amount of product. So the substrate is continually decreasing in linear form. The product is increasing in a linear form. But if you notice, the amount of enzyme substrate over time is essentially what? The same. There's no change in the enzyme substrate over time, as long as the substrate is sufficient to keep that enzyme substrate occupied, or keep the enzyme site bound with substrate. Only near the end, where the amount of substrate begins to drop off significantly, does the amount of enzyme substrate begin to decrease and the amount of free enzyme begin to increase. This diagram is a very powerful tale to tell about the behavior of enzymes and substrates over a short time frame reaction. But the critical piece of information right there is that DES over DT approximates zero. That is the steady state assumption. And it's easy to see in this graphical form. And therefore, it can make this statement right here. This statement is identical to this statement up here. It is. And so this is the statement. That is the assumption, the steady state assumption, that allows us to algebraically manipulate a couple of equations to produce the Michaelis-Menten equation. So, given this DES equals DT, we then can go back and look at this particular diagram right here and see where it says DES over DT is equal to the rate of its formation minus the rate of its loss by reverse reaction minus the rate of its loss by forward reaction. If I set that DES DT to zero, which is this statement, making it a steady state, I end up with this equation right here. Can you see this equation? Is it adequate? Can you see it? Yeah. Where I set this is equal to zero, K1 ES minus K minus 1 ES minus K1 ES. By setting this equal to zero, then I can rearrange this. I simply take these two factors, move them over to the other side, and by changing the side, I'm changing the sign. Remember that from Algebra 1? Change the side, change the sign. right? Remember that? Remember this? You remember this? This also, this equation here. Where L minus L equals Christmas, right? You remember that, right? L minus L equals Noel, right? Thank you very much. Noel, Christmas, Noel. It's a bad pun, and I'm keeping it in the audio. I'm sorry. Exactly. Oh, come on. You're going to run into a fifth grader. You're going to think of this, and you're going to tell them that around Christmas time, and they'll think you're the funniest thing since sliced bread. Oh, Mom, where'd you get that? That's cool. It's a great pun. And you'll roll your eyes and say, I don't want to tell you. All right. So I taught algebra for 8 years. So that's, if you can imagine me teaching algebra for 8 years. All the really bad jokes I had. Okay, so we move this over here, obviously. Then what do we do with this? So we get this, and then we have this assumption where the enzyme total is equal to E plus S. Duh. We solve for E. We get ET minus ES. Change the sign. And then you come over here, and where this E is, you follow along where you have the happy biochemists, girls and boys, come over here, and you substitute in here. You substitute in here, then what do you do? Well, what you can do is take this thing once it's substituted in there, and you can rearrange it to form this. Actually, it equals that, if you'll notice, when it comes around. And then you can rearrange it to form that. And I've done it. It's only about 3 steps algebraically. Just take some time to think about it. I will not ask you on a test or whatever to do it, but it's handy-dandy because it looks complicated, but it isn't. You'll increase your confidence in your algebra if you go ahead and make those substitutions. You rearrange this, and then what you do is you divide by that k minus 1 on both sides, of course, and then you solve for ES because you have ES over here as a term by itself, and you get this ET. ES is equal to ET times S all over KM plus S. Now that KM is a new factor, called Michaelis-Menten constant. And that KM, Michaelis-Menten constant, actually turns out to be K minus 1 plus K2 over K minus 1. These microscopic rate constants end up having a new constant, KM. Obviously, a constant plus a constant divided by a constant must be equal to what? A constant. Well, so they call it KM. Michaelis-Menten constant, KM. Now, what we do then is we have to understand something. The DS, DES here, is that correct? You see DES? See that ES right there? Remember I said the velocity by definition is equal to the change in product over time? And at T0, it approximates K2, if you recall, the production of the product. You see where the production of the product here is the rate constant times the enzyme substrate concentration, so it's K2ES equals the V0 or V. So what you do is, if you take, you multiply K2 here, and you multiply K2 here. You basically multiply both sides by K2. Multiply both sides by K2. Now, K2ES, by definition, is the velocity. And I said, remember this velocity here? So this becomes the velocity. Velocity is equal then to K2ETS all over KM plus S. Well, what's this K2ET? K2ET. Now, that ET stands for enzyme total. So, can you have a reaction move any faster than ET? I mean, the K2ET? No, because what that means is that all the enzyme is completely saturated, so it's all ES. So, if you have all of the ET as acting as completely consumed, making that ES, then K2 times ET is equal to this new term called Vmax. So then V0 equals Vmax S all over Km plus S. And that is the Michaelis-Menten equation right there. The V0, and please write this down, the V0 is the initial velocity. V0 is the initial velocity. Typically within the first 10% of the reaction consumption. V0 is the initial velocity, typically, then that initial means it's within the first 10% of the substrate consumption. Okay? Now, what is the physical significance of Km? Well, Km is the measure of the affinity of an enzyme for a substrate, assuming that K2 is less than K1. There have been arguments, long heated arguments, about what the physical significance of Km really is. One of them is it's kind of like a measure of a binding for the enzyme, the substrate binding affinity. Others argue that's not exactly the case. So, depending on the circumstances, you may hear that assumption where a small Km means tight binding and a large Km means loose binding. So why did you write that down? A small Km means tight binding and a large Km means relatively loose binding. A small Km means tight binding. A large Km means loose binding. That, when I'm talking about binding, I'm about the enzyme and substrate, how strongly they bond together. But there is an absolute guaranteed understanding for what Km. Okay. And here it is. Please write this down. If the substrate concentration equals the Km. If the substrate concentration equals the Km, then the velocity is half max. If the substrate concentration equals the Km value, I'm going to expand it, it's all the same thing. If the substrate concentration in an experiment is equal to the Km value, then the velocity is of that experiment is half max. This really is extremely easy to understand. All right? We know V equals V max S all over Km plus S. Note as well, the Km will always have the same units of concentration as the substrate. All right, Km units equals the substrate units. Whatever those units are. If the units are micromole per minute, then the substrate is micromole per minute. That was a velocity, sorry. If the substrate is millimolar, then the Km is millimolar. If the substrate is micromolar, then the Km is micromolar. But what did I say? If the Km is equal to S. Well, all I need to do is substitute S for the Km in here. V is equal to V max S all over S plus S. Of course, S plus S is how many S's? So V max times S all over 2S. What do I get to do with the S's? Cancel them out, and I have what? V is equal to what? Vmax divided by what? Which is, of course, what? Half Vmax. You must know that relationship. If there's anything in enzyme behavior that's ubiquitous and guaranteed to be true, it's that statement. You cannot forget this. Andrews University biochem graduates who've taken this class, do not forget that one phrase. And what is it? If the substrate concentration equals what? Km. Then what? Velocity is what? Half Vmax. All right? I will become angry with you individually if I see an error in that logic. Ooh, he's getting ornery about this. Do not forget it. All right? All right. So much for being unpleasant. So you can see here that if here's an experiment that went on, and they've taken the substrate, but they've taken it in units of km. Now the km is an experimentally measured number. So every km is going to be a little different. But assuming that you can find the km and then take the km and simply have concentration units equal to the km, ratios of km, 1 km, 2 km, 3 km, 4 km, 5 km, and you have here a velocity on the vertical axis and the V max listed here, you can, if you put plot km, and you automatically get half V max. Duh. Very straightforward. Now, let's take a look at two important constants that are in any of these reactions. The first constant is the Vmax, which stands for what? And the Km, which is called the what? Michaelis-Menten constant. Correct. How do we determine that experimentally, ladies and gentlemen? Well, as it turns out, this equation right here can be reformatted and rearranged to form a linear equation. And that linear equation here is 1 over V0 equals Km over Vmax times 1 over S times 1 over Vmax. You must also memorize that equation. Right? Graduates or people who have taken this class at this university will know that equation. Right? That equation is called the Lineweaver-Burk plot. Lineweaver-Burk plot. And I want you to note how come it's linear. Why is it a linear equation? Well, what is a linear equation, ladies and gentlemen? What's the universal form for a linear equation in algebra? Y equals mx plus b. Oh, my goodness. There we go again. Can you, based on this thing, tell me what the y-intercept is? What's the y-intercept according to this model right here? 1 over Vmax. What is the slope? Km over Vmax. And you can see that right here. Slope is equal to Km over Vmax. This intercept here is 1 over Vmax. So if you can either, and notice the x-intercept is negative 1 over Km. So by plotting real data and extrapolating using a trend line or a linear regression statistical analysis, you can determine the y-intercept and the x-intercept and find the two constants that are unique to that particular enzyme and enzyme conditions. What's the name of this equation? Lineweaver-Burk. And you can plot that to make a Lineweaver-Burk plot. Now, there's only a little problem with this, and that is that, you know, you got 1 over V0, that's an inverse value. You're plotting velocity versus substrate concentration. But when you're actually plotting, you're plotting inverse of substrate versus inverse of velocity. And what happens is that has a tendency to crowd data together in the higher concentrations and spread them out over the lower concentrations. And notice the error bars. Can you see the error bars here? You see this little error bar right here? Notice how long that is. And notice the error bar on the other end. Notice how narrow that is. It means that if you have a mistake way out here and these way out here, which is likely to happen, you're going to get a fairly wide variation of 1 over Vmax and 1 over Km. It is what it is, but that is a problem. Most data is crowded on the left, so the plot can have large errors if you're not careful. Now, I'm going to give you some raw data. Just like this. Do you see that on the next page? You see the raw data? I'm going to show you how to do this using Excel. How many people know and love Excel? The spreadsheet program. You know of it? Have you used it much?
Yes.
We don't love it, yeah. Yeah, no love involved with that. Yes. Far be it from us to love that kind of thing. Yes, I understand completely. What we're going to do is we're going to take a look at it. And let's see here. Oop, CPS. Come on, where's my Excel? There it is. There's my Excel plot. Now, I would like for you to note, if you don't mind, ladies and gentlemen, is this big enough to see, or do I need to increase the size? Let's make it 125%. Is that better? How about 150%? Is that better? How about 200%? I think you're good, Dave. Don't worry about it. Okay. Now, so what I want you to note here, of course, is bold centered. And you can see there, I've got the S on one column and the V on the other. Now, the S, of course, stands for the what? Substrate concentration that we see right here. Substrate. And then the V, of course, stands for the velocity that we got for that particular reaction. So what I've done is I've simply plotted this. Oh, I can't. On every program except PowerPoint. When I press this button right here, I get a laser pointer. On Word, on Excel, this sends some sort of stupid function to them. And so I try to use a laser pointer and, oh, this thing shows up. It's just so annoying, I can't stand it. Anyway. All right, so I guess I'll just have to wave and point. So where did I get the numbers? Why is it way not in the middle here? Why? I mean, okay, where did I get the numbers for this column? Where did I get those numbers? Look on your sheet, where did I get those numbers? Ah, there's the yardstick. Okay, where did I get the numbers? Oh, one on the floor, that's right. What's nice about this one is I can stand here, right, and then whack the second row. Except I can't whack the second row. Why not? Because I'm no whack. Anyway, so here we have the vertical line right here. Where did I get those numbers from? Yeah, where did I get these numbers from? And where did I get the 1 over S from? Yeah, you put 1 over S. Notice if you would, I don't know, do I show the equation somewhere? Ah, you see up here, notice all I've done is, yeah, right here. Notice all I've done is I've got that 1 over A2, which is at inverse. And then if I go over, I simply have done that right there. And I've got 1 over B2. And so I have the inversions of it. Now, that is the raw data for a Lineweaver-Burk plot. How to use Excel to get that Lineweaver-Burk plot? Well, what you do is, typically, you have the 1 over S and 1 over V, and you highlight it. Oh, come on, highlight it. All right, you highlight it like this. And then you go up to where it says gallery. I'm going to turn off the gallery. It says gallery and click on charts. See where I'm clicking on charts? Hello? Yeah. Now then, there are pages and pages of charts. Not all of them work very well. Matter of fact, most of them don't work very well for this particular purpose. What you have to do is you have to go over and find the one. Whoop. I'm going the wrong direction. It should say this one right there. You see where it says straight marked scatter? You want the scatter plot. You want the scatter plot is the best way to do this. Scatter plot. So you click on that. And immediately, look at that. It gives you that plot. Isn't that sweeter? It's slicker than sliced bread. Oh, come on. I don't want to move it. I want to size it. There we go. Let me shrink a little bit. All right, so you got that strange size like that. Do you see that, ladies and gentlemen? Is it visible on the overhead? Okay, good. Now, how do you use that to get the Lineweaver-Burk information? Well, what you do is you click on the chart to highlight it. See, now it's got all those fancy-dancy X's around there. Then you go over here to where it says Tools. And you go here, Chart. Ah, Chart. And you go to where it says Add Trend Line. And then you get this. What do you see? Okay. Then you get this chart. What you first typically get is this line. You don't worry about it. Shadow. You don't worry about a shadow. Type.
Well, you do want to make sure it's the trend linear. You want the linear regression. Then you go down here to options. Is everybody following me on this? Okay. What you do is, to really do this very nicely, if you want to display the equation, you do that. That's very handy. And sometimes you can actually make it cross the... you can make it cross the axis here. Did that make it do it? No. Anyway, you have to fiddle with that. I'm not going to worry about that so much. But anyway, I want to show you now the important information that you can get out of this. And the key here is that equation. Notice the equation there. Notice what I said? Show the equation of the line. And so you have the equation of the line. Now you have y is equal to 4 times 10 to the minus 7 x plus 0.0147. This equation right here. Where did I get that from? I got that from the trend line using the option form. So, got that beautiful trend line, blah, blah, blah. Now, that equation, amazingly enough, is the equation of the line, where y equals, you know, y. So now we have the slope, which is what value? What's the slope? And what's the y-intercept? Yeah. So can we figure out what the Vmax is? Well, yes, we can. Absolutely. We know that b is equal to 1 over Vmax. Agreed? Agreed? Yes. And we know that B is equal to 0.0147. Could someone plug in the inverse of 0.0147 for me, and we get Vmax is equal to what? What's the inverse of 0.0147? Anybody have a calculator? Don't tell me. I can't use my calculator. I've got it in my pocket, and I'm recording stuff with it. So if someone could just quickly do that for me. 68.03, and the units, what was the velocity units that they had in the problem? What was it? Micromoles per what? So this is micromoles per minute. That's that. Now, what do we know that M is equal to? M is equal to what? M is the slope. It's equal to what? Km over what? Vmax. All right. We also know M has a value of 4 times 10 to the minus 7. We also know that Vmax is equal to that. So we have Km all over 68.03 micromole per minute is equal to 4 times 10 to the minus 7. And could someone multiply 68... times 4 times 10 to the minus 7th for me. Oh, it was what? To what? 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5. 2.7 times 10 to the minus 5 is equal to the Km value. And the Km value is always equal to the substrate concentration. And what was the substrate concentration that we on the chart? Moles per liter. So 0.27. So now we have figured, using the Lineweaver-Burk plot and raw data, we've calculated the Vmax and the Km. All right. Yes. Absolutely. You can do it with a graphing calculator if you have one. And it works very, very nicely. Very, very nicely. All right. Well, let's go back to reality now. Any questions about this, ladies and gentlemen? Did it make sense when you saw it? Excellent. Excellent. Okay, now I get to start using my PowerPoint again. So, here's the next figure after that particular exercise. Again, you see here where you've got that, we've seen that, that graph before where the enzyme substrate concentration is essentially flat as the substrate decreases and the product increases. What they've done is they've simply amplified that little early, microscopically early, less than a 1%, less than a half a percent progression along time. And they see here that you have all the free enzyme eventually decreases to a low level. The enzyme substrate quickly builds up as the product begins to produce. And so this is basically where V0 is occurring. This is about where V0 is occurring. The initial velocity occurs within that first 10%. Understanding Km, I have no idea. Some people call it the kinetic activator constant. I've never heard that term except in this textbook. Km is a constant. Km is derived from rate constants, microscopic. Km under true Michaelis-Menten conditions, and what that means by true Michaelis-Menten conditions, I don't know. It's an estimate of the dissociation constant E from S. Small Km means tight binding. High Km means white weak binding. I think I just said that, didn't I? Yes, I did. So you need to, apparently, since I've said it twice, it must be really, really important. All right, and we're understanding Vmax, theoretical maximum velocity. Vmax is a constant. Vmax is theoretical maximum rate, but never reached in reality. To reach Vmax, require that all the enzyme molecules are tightly bound with substrate. Vmax is asymmetrically approached as substrate is increased. All right. Do you have your clickers on, ladies and gentlemen? Yeah, I do. Good. We now have a clicker quiz coming up. We're jumping down to question 4. Are you ready? Are you joined up? Okay. The equation LNA is equal to LNA0 minus KT defines mathematically a zeroth order, first order, second order, third order reaction. Zeroth, first order, second order, third order reaction. And time is beginning, ladies and gentlemen. You have 20 seconds. Quickly review. Okay. What do you think? Oh, my goodness. What's going on here? Let's see. Why is this one being cut off and the others are not? Okay, 88% correct. That's right. First order reaction. Why is it a first order reaction, ladies and gentlemen? Because that is, of course, that defines what kind of equation is that? It's a linear equation, where ln of A equals minus KT plus ln A0. Right? And the next question, and the last one of these two, is for an enzyme-catalyzed reaction, if the blank equals Km, then the blank is half blank. Blankety blank blank blank. For an enzyme catalyzed reaction, if the blank is equals to Km, then the blank is half blank. What do you think? There it is. Hey! Cool. Unfortunately, this is just two questions. Always a clause. Yes. Either it's... Yeah. I'm sorry. I just can't help it. Exactly. Look at this. Congratulations, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? Because if someone had gotten it wrong, I was going to chase you down. And so, at any rate, so I'm glad you recalled. Thank you very much. We're done for this for the day. We've got to go on. We do not have another one. Quit. Quit. And it's uploading the data. Thank you very much. Then we go here. We get this. All right. Next. Dual nature of Michaelis-Menten equation. Combination of zero order and first order kinetics. When S is low, the equation for rate is first order in S. Huh? What? What does that mean exactly? What does it mean? What is the Michaelis-Menten equation, by the way, ladies and gentlemen? V0 is equal to what? Somebody shout it out. It's a fraction. What's the top term? Vmax times what? Substrate concentration all over what? Km plus what? Substrate.
Okay. Now, when S is low, the equation is for rate is first order in S. This means
for if the S is low, that means concentration of S is much less than the Km.
If that's the case, if then Km plus S is equal to, approximates Km. If the substrate concentration is less than the Km value, then Km plus S is approximately equals at Km. Would you agree with that as a first approximation? Hello? Would you agree with that? Thank you very much. So if that's the case, then V0 is equal to Vmax all over S Km. Now, why is this first order? Well, V0 is equal to Km, no, Vmax all over Km times S. Well, that's just a linear equation. That's first order. This is just a direct, as S increases, the V increases. That's first order. When S is high, the equation for rate is zero order in S. Zero order in S. So here we go. Same idea. When S is high, it's zero order in S. That's because here, if S is much greater than Km, then Km plus S is equal to what? S. If S is much larger than the Km value, then Km plus S is equal to approximately equals S. Agreed or disagree? Somebody say agree. Am I going too fast? Got this all written down yet? This is supposed to be what? Vmax? All right. That's Vmax. All right. And so this is first order right here. But so, if S is much greater than Km, then Km plus S is equal to S. Thus, V0 is equal to Vmax S all over S. If that's the case, then V0 is equal to simply Vmax, which, of course, is zeroth order because there's no variability with it. So that's why the Michaelis-Menten plot of simp, that's why it looks like this. Okay, you got your velocity here, you got the substrate here, you got something that looks like this. This is first order. This up here is zeroth order. That's why. Okay? The substrate is much greater than all that. So, zeroth order, first order, that's why. The Michaelis-Menten equation describes a rectangular hyperbole dependence of velocity on substrate concentration. Yes. Oh, okay. Sorry. Carolyn, sorry. Turnover number. And this is not the number of pastries that you can eat in a day. All right? Sorry, Mr. Bobienko. I know that was your first impression. Okay. Now, measure of catalytic activity. KCAT. The turnover number is the number of substrate molecules converted to product per enzyme molecule per unit of time when E is saturated with substrate. If the Michaelis-Menten model fits, which most times we assume that it does, we see that K2 is the same thing as KCAT. So K2 and KCAT are the same thing. But you can calculate KCAT by taking the maximum velocity and dividing it by the molar enzyme total, molarity of the total number of enzyme sites, enzyme active sites. So I'm going to go back here, follow along. I'm going to move back. What did I say here? K2 equals what? KCAT. And KCAT is called the what? Well, let's find out where that is.
There's K2. Right there. K2 is right there in the early stages of this whole process. So you could call K2 equal to what? K-cat. And how do you calculate K-cat, ladies and gentlemen? You take your what? Your Vmax that you calculated and divide it by the ET. All right, so on your notes, please write ET is this. ET in this case is the number of moles of active site. The reason I have to put it like that is because there are enzymes that have one protein but two active sites, or three active sites, or four active sites. So the ET is the number of active sites in moles. And so you have to be very careful about that particular number. On Friday, I'm going to give you some enzyme homework beyond the school, I mean, beyond what we have in the text. And it'll be a lot of fun. Yes?
You said the number of moles of active site.
Correct.
The number of moles of substrate in the active site? Or the...
Just the... No. What is it? Number of moles of substrate in the active site? No. Whether the active site has substrate in it or not. The substrate is the reactant. The enzyme is a catalyst. And the number of moles of active site on that catalyst, whether there's a substrate bound to it or not. Alright, now, catalytic efficiency, ladies and gentlemen. Can you have a perfect enzyme? Yes, you can. An estimate of how perfect the enzyme is kcat over km. An apparent, which means approximate, second order rate constant, I'm going to worry about that too much. It measures how the enzyme performs when S is slow. The upper limit for kcat over km is the diffusion limit. The rate at which E and S diffuse together. In other words, let me go back here. Okay. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, we know that in order for an enzyme to react, the substrate and the enzyme have to collide. Oh, I'm sorry. Have to collide. Is that correct? Physically touch. Now, if you have an enzyme over on this little part of the solution and a substrate over here, what brings them together? Brownian movement or diffusion, is that correct? How fast does that substrate meet that enzyme is based on Brownian movement or diffusion rate. There are enzymes whose catalytic rate is as fast as the diffusion rate. Now think about that. Enzymes that are as fast as the diffusion rate. In other words, they act so quickly on the substrate, they're equal to the same speed as the substrate being brought to them by simple diffusion through the medium. That is called the perfect enzyme. It's remarkable in the aspect that the enzyme is a three-dimensional substrate, and the active site's only one part of that three dimensions, but nevertheless, it's still acting as fast as that substrate is being brought to it. Perfect enzyme, ladies and gentlemen, and there are some in your body. Thank you very much. We'll see you on tomorrow. Wonderful.